October 17, 2014. Tonight's Institute of Leadership Studies event featuring Leon Panetta is brought to you by the Borowski School of Business and Penguin Radio.
Thank you and welcome. I am thrilled to be here this afternoon, and I'm honored to be doing something that we don't get to do very often, which is to publicly acknowledge and thank people who have made a difference, not just in one of our lives, but in all of our lives. Leon Panetta is a remarkable, remarkable public servant, and he has been for decades. And one of the great attractions for me and great pleasant surprises in coming to Dominican was realizing that we had a relationship with the Panetta Institute, and that our students worked with the Panetta Institute every year, and that I would have a chance to meet and get to know Leon Panetta and his wife, Sylvia. What I didn't know at the time, and I've since learned, is the reason, one of the reasons we have a relationship with the Panetta Institute is that Leon's wife, Sylvia, is a proud alumna of Dominican University of California. So I will be relatively brief because if you took the time to outline Secretary Panetta's entire leadership history, we wouldn't have time for any conversation. And I think that you have seen him enough on TV and over the years that you know a lot of the highlights. So I want to hit just a few of them. What you may not remember, you may have known at one point, is that Secretary Panetta has served as a Republican in the Nixon administration and as a Democrat in the Clinton and Obama administrations. He has a habit of being on the right side of history, which means that he was fired by the Nixon administration. He created the Monterey Bay Marine Sanctuary when he was a member of Congress. He balanced the budget in the Clinton administration. He helped eliminate Don't Ask, Don't Tell when he was in the Obama administration. And he's been involved in numerous other major decisions nationally and indeed in the world. He began his political career working in the Department of Health, Education, and Welfare. Then he became a congressman from California, where he was reelected 8 times. He unseated an incumbent, which was particularly hard to do in that era. He's a director of the Office of Management and Budget, White House Chief of Staff for President Bill Clinton, and later director of Central Intelligence Agency, and finally, Secretary of Defense. I mentioned that he helped found the Panetta Institute with his wife, Sylvia. The Panetta Institute, among other things, helps train the next generation of public servants. And I am very happy to say that a number of Dominican alumni have participated as interns and in that leadership program at the Panetta Institute. And many of these alumni are with us today and have remained in public service. So I'd like them to please stand so we could recognize them. Welcome back. And if you really want to hear stories about Secretary Panetta, I suspect these are the people to talk to. I will say, in being on the right side of history, sometimes it's the grand things, and sometimes it's just good instincts and good timing. For example, one of the many things in the midst of book tours and television appearances that Secretary Panetta did this year was he threw out the first pitch at a Giants-Dodgers baseball game. He will also soon receive one of the nation's highest honors, the William J. Donovan Award, named after General Donovan, the only American to have received our nation's 4 highest awards, including the Medal of Honor. The Donovan Award is given for distinguished service in the interest of the democratic process and the case for freedom, and it is hard to imagine an American more deserving of this award than Leon Panetta. Please join me in welcoming back to Dominican Secretary Leon Panetta.
Welcome back.
Nice to be back. This is a lot of history here for both myself and my wife, we first met it was an open house at Santa Clara. In those days, this was an all-women's school, and Santa Clara was an all men's school, and we used to invite all of the Catholic women's schools to come down for an open house. And
it's very thoughtful.
That's the way it was in those days. and we pinned corsages on the girls as they got off the buses. And that's how I met Sylvia. She was one of those coming to the open house, and something clicked. And from then on, I came here for some dances that were held here at Fanjo and had a chance to spend some time here. It's a good thing I was telling Mary that one night I slept in a car outside of her dorm. And it's a lucky thing that the nuns didn't throw me in jail at that point. So.
They didn't need to. They already knew his name. They knew where he lived. They knew the entire hierarchy at Santa Clara. It was
you got
under control. Well, I know that we have an audience that is very interested in current events and well-informed, and I also know that you have been on a formidable book tour, and this isn't headline news. So I think that rather than diving right into the same questions that many folks have asked you, I wanted to explore a little bit some of the other areas that you talk about in your
Great.
Book. And I know there'll be time for Q&A later, and we will certainly get to current events, but what people may not know from some of the interviews and some of the sound bites that the media has picked up is how profound a memoir this is and how fully it encaptures the life of a remarkable public servant. And I thought we could talk a little bit about some of the other pieces along the way. And we can end with Ebola and ISIS and Iraq and Syria and whatever else we need to talk about. But one of the things that struck me immediately in reading your book, and I wasn't aware of it, is something that we think a lot about at Dominican, and in fact we talk a lot about in higher education. We talk about first-generation college students and first-generation Americans and the importance of opportunity and the opportunity that higher education can offer. What I didn't know is that you were a first-generation college student, and in fact you were the first generation in your family to be born in the United States.
Right.
Could you talk a little bit about your family history and what before you got to Santa Clara, what led you to Santa Clara and ultimately to Sylvia?
Yeah, sure. I really had the privilege in many ways of living the American dream. I was the son of Italian immigrants, and they came here like millions of others in the early 30s. Little money in their pocket, few language abilities, few skills. Traveled all of that distance to a strange land. I used to ask my father, why would you do that? Because even though they came from a poor area in Italy, Calabria, they at least had the comfort of family. So why would you leave all of that, to travel all of that distance to a strange land? This was not a time of Google or the internet. They didn't know where the hell they were going when they got on a ship to come to this country. And so I asked him that, and I'll never forget his answer, which was that my mother and he believed that they could give their children a better life in this country, which is in many ways the American dream. That's what we want for our children and for their children. And they worked hard. They struggled. They sacrificed. My father was the 13th in his family, and he had several brothers who came over before him. One brother, his oldest brother, Bruno, settled in Sheridan, Wyoming. I think he worked in the mines, worked on the railroads like immigrants in those days, and then worked in the mines and then, you know, got settled in a grocery business there. And then another brother, Tony, came out to California. So according to Italian tradition, you should visit your older brother first. And so when they came, they went and visited Bruno in Sheridan, Wyoming, and spent one winter in Sheridan, Wyoming. And my mother suggested it was time to visit the other brother in California.
Even without Google, they figured that out. That was good.
So they did and managed to make their way to Monterey, thank God, where I was born. And my father opened a restaurant in downtown Monterey during the war years, Monterey was kind of a jumping town in those days for a couple reasons. One, they were catching a lot of sardines. Cannery Row Steinbeck's Cannery Row was in full-fledged operation there. So that was, there was a lot of work and and families that were involved in the fishing industry. But in addition to that, there was Fort Ord, which was a military training post. All of these young men were coming from across the country and being trained there to go to the battlefields of World War II. And so you can imagine Monterey, downtown Monterey, was kind of the last stop in terms of civilization for them. So, you know, downtown Monterey was jumping. And my father did the cooking in the restaurant. My mother handled the cash register. She had a button under the cash register to call the MPs if anybody got fresh with her. And she did that a few times. And my father went after a few guys with his knife a few times. And again, you know, they were hardworking. I mean, it, you know, start at 6 o'clock in the morning and sometimes go till 2 a.m. in the morning, because that's when the bars closed. And they stayed open that time. And my earliest recollections were washing glasses in the back of that restaurant on a chair. My parents believed that child labor was a requirement for us. And that was kind of the nature of it, that, you know, we were all working hard. And after the war, my dad sold the restaurant and he bought some property in Carmel Valley and planted a walnut orchard. And again, we were working out there. My brother and I were working with him, irrigation pipes, working with a hoe, doing all the work that had to be done. And I tell this story because as the walnut trees got older, my father would go around with a pole and hook in those days and shake each of the branches. And we would be underneath collecting the walnuts. When I got elected to Congress, my father said, you know, you've been well trained to go to Washington because you've been dodging nuts all your life, which was true. They believed deeply in this country. My father and mother both encouraged that we would get involved with public service and give something back to the country that gave them the opportunity that they enjoyed. And for that reason, I became, you know, very interested in you know, student body activities when I was in high school. Same thing in college. And then I got, you know, I took a poli-sci major. Went to law school, and then I had to go in the Army because I went through ROTC and had to serve for 2 years in the Army. And when I got out of the Army, my father wanted me to go into practice with my brother in Monterey. And I said, you know, I really want to do something. I really want to do more. And I didn't know anybody in Washington. I didn't have any ties. You know, my parents were not politically active. But I decided to write an aide to Lyndon Johnson, whose name was Joe Califano. And the only reason I wrote him is because his name was Califano and my name was Panetta. So I wrote him a letter and I said, you know, I'm really very proud of the fact that there's an Italian American working in the White House for the president. And, you know, I'd really like some help to see if there were some opportunities to come back and work there. Well, sure enough, he called. I was in the G2 shop, which is the intelligence shop, at Fort Ord, and I got a call from Joe Califano, who actually set up some appointments in Washington and had a chance to do that. Ultimately, I used that as an opportunity to go to Capitol Hill, and I walked into the office of then-Senator Tom Kuchel, who was a Republican senator from California, and sure enough, he gave me the job. And, you know, 50 years later, I was still in Washington.
Yes. And it was a background that invited you to give back and invited you to public service. But it's interesting, too, to find the pieces that informed you later that were not always as positive. And one of the things that your family went through was that your Italian grandfather was here when the Second World War began.
Yeah. He came over in 1938. To visit my mother, and the war broke out, and they would not allow Italian aliens to go back to Italy. It really helped me because he basically babysat and took care of me while my parents were working in the restaurant. And my grandfather was kind of this big, very wonderful guy who had a great smile, was a wonderful person. he didn't speak much English, and so if I was going to eat, I had to learn Italian, because otherwise I wasn't going to get anything to eat. And so I learned how to, you know, Italian and speak with him, and he used to take me for walks down by the wharf, and he used to engage in conversations with a lot of the Italians that were there. And then, you know, I really, you know, as I said, he was really the person who helped, you know, to raise both my brother and I. And then they decided to order alien Italians inland because they were considered security risks. And so we had to find a place for him in San Jose to live. And we finally found a rooming house there. And I remember driving him to San Jose with my family. And my eyes were full of tears because I didn't understand why my grandfather, you know, was being forced to go inland. And, you know, Norm Mineta is a dear friend. We served together in the Congress, and it's nothing like, obviously, the internment that the Japanese Americans went through. But I think we both used to talk about having similar feelings about, you know, knowing what was happening, but at the same time being very devoted to this country, and it kind of, you know, makes you think a lot about what our responsibilities are. By the way, just a fun thing, Norm's last name was Mineta. My name was Panetta. We were both in the Congress together, and Tip O'Neill could never get us straight. He used to always call me Norm. He called Norm Leon. What was even worse was the Carter administration couldn't get us straight. So when the Italian prime minister would come to town, they would invite Norm Mineta to the White House. And when the Japanese prime minister came, they would invite me to go to the White House. And, you know, Norm and I took it all in good fun. We finally put a softball team together and said we played under the sign of the rising pizza. That was our symbol for our softball team.
The Mineta Panettas. Well, I'm going to fast forward a little bit further into some of the work that you became very well known for, but I'm going to draw on your past and give you a little bit of a hard time, or perhaps our students some hope. And I don't know that you draw this parallel. It's you know, it's the pedantic academic in me. You talk about your early schooling and some of the activities you're involved in. You also said you really loved civics and you were interested in history, and you weren't so good at algebra. And then a few decades later.
Algebra.
A few decades later, how do you make your name in Congress? By running the budget committee. And a decade after that, you're in charge of the Office of Management and Budget. Should we take this as a sign of hope or as a sign of trepidation?
Well, I think it is a sign of hope, because I've always been a pragmatist. And, you know, algebra formulas and algebra used to always drive me nuts. But, you know, when I sat down with a budget where there were numbers assigned to programs, that I understood, and that I could work with. And, you know, it was because the thing that attracted me to the budget committee was the fact that, you know, budgets are really not just about numbers. They're about priorities. I mean, we reflect our priorities in our budgets, and that's true at the federal government level as well. And so the ability to work with the entire federal budget and to look at the priorities of the president and of the Congress and to determine, you know, how many resources are we going to devote to various programs was really an introduction for me into what government is all about and the responsibilities that we have. And it really made me understand not just one program. I mean, members of Congress sometimes get boxed in one committee or another and then get tied. You know, because I was on the Ag Committee, I could have spent, you know, all of my life working on agricultural issues. But the budget opened up the full spectrum of all of the activities that we were involved in. And, you know, and I also learned there are good programs and there's lousy programs. There are effective programs and there are programs that are a waste. And the ability to kind of work through that, understand it, be able to make judgments on priorities became something that I truly enjoyed, both in the Congress and then as OMB director with Bill Clinton.
Well, one of the things that really comes through in your book, and because I'm a political scientist, I say this with great, you know, with great, this is a great accolade, but you're truly a policy wonk in the sense that you didn't want to just have grand ideas. You wanted to know how they were going to affect people and what the difference was going to be 5 or 10 years down the line. The other thing that comes through, which I want to ask you about in terms of the current climate, is that you seem to take great joy in that part of politics that not everyone enjoys, which is working behind the scenes, trying to find the compromise, kind of understanding what's going to make a bill get passed or get through, even if it involves compromise on your own end. There's so much conversation right now about the climate in Washington. I wonder if you could talk a little bit about what you see that's different and what isn't from that era.
Yeah, no, it's a real concern that I think people ask me about the biggest threat to our national security. The biggest threat to our national security is the dysfunction in Washington and the inability of both parties, President and Congress, to be able to work together to deal with the issues confronting this country. I've seen Washington at its best, and I've seen Washington at its worst. I mean, I have seen Washington work. I mean, when I first went back as a legislative assistant to Senator Kuchel, who was a progressive Republican out of the Hiram Johnson tradition in California, Earl Warren, Goody Knight, others like that. When I went back, Kuchel was very much involved on issues and involvement with a lot of Democrats. But there were other Republicans there as well. Some in the audience might remember some of these names. People like Jacob Javits from New York, Clifford Case from New Jersey, Hugh Scott from Pennsylvania, George Aiken from Vermont, Cooper from Kentucky, Hatfield from Oregon. And they were working with people like, you know, Henry Jackson from Washington, and Magnuson, and Mansfield, and Fulbright, and Dick Russell, and Sam Ervin, who were people who really were statesmen. Of course they had their political differences. Yes, they fought each other in political campaigns. But when it came to the big issues, they really felt it was their responsibility to work together on these big issues. Kuchel worked with Henry Jackson on developing the Redwood Parks, and I saw him, you know, negotiate that proposal. Kuchel worked with Javits and others on civil rights legislation. Lyndon Johnson obviously was moving civil rights legislation. We were working together. Everett Dirksen was involved in working on civil rights legislation. So they produced some landmark legislation by virtue of working together, and it was important for the country. When I got elected to Congress, Tip O'Neill was the speaker, and Bob Michael was the minority leader. They had their differences, but on big issues facing the country, whether it came from a Republican president like Ronald Reagan or a Democratic president, Carter, they worked together to try to make sure they could produce what was needed for the country. I mean, I was trained in that atmosphere, which was to work on a bipartisan basis with others to try to develop legislation. And that was really encouraging for me. I was not somebody who just wanted to sit down just shuffle papers and not get things done. I wanted to represent my district. I wanted to deliver things back to my district. And so I learned from all of my history, okay, how do we get these things done? I mean, a good example, you talked about the Monterey Bay Marine Sanctuary. Well, when the Reagan administration came in, it was a guy named Secretary Watt who was in Interior. Well, Watt wanted to put up the entire coastline for sale for offshore drilling. And, you know, I said, wait a minute, I represent Monterey area, Big Sur, area that is extremely attractive, coastline. And I said, he can't be serious about wanting to put that up for sale. So I got another congressman, Don Clawson, who was a Republican from Mendocino in that area. And I said, we've got to go see him. So we did. And I said, Secretary Watt, I said, I know the need for energy and the need to be able to develop some of this. But I said, there are areas that are pristine, that are national treasures like Yellowstone and Yosemite, and that's what Big Sur is all about, that need to be protected. And he said, everything ought to be sold, and if there's some areas that can be protected, we'll fight that out later. I said, no, that's not good enough.
So what we did is I put together legislation on an appropriations bill that basically stopped funding. So it's a little gimmick you can use to get your policy across. I used the appropriations bill to say no funds shall be used for the purpose of developing offshore drilling. And that stops it. I was able to build a coalition, Republicans, Democrats. I got other states interested in it, Oregon, Washington, some of the states on the East Coast. And we were able to pass that legislation. It was called a moratorium. We passed it every year, I think, for a number of years it was passed. But I worried that in an energy crisis, it was going to lose. And so for that reason, developed the idea of establishing a permanent Monterey Bay National Marine Sanctuary. And so I developed the legislation on that. NOAA had looked at it, but then dropped the idea. And I said, well, damn it, I'm going to pass it legislatively. And what I did was I took that legislation and I tied it to another bill that I knew was going to go to the White House and be signed. Mm-hmm. I buried it in the bill. And it passed. And when the president signed the bill, the Monterey Bay Sanctuary was created. Now, I go through that because the nature of governing is that it is a give and take process. It is a process of working towards consensus. It's a process of having to fight your way in order to get things done. That's the nature of legislating. And governing, look, governing is not easy. I know that. God, I 50 years I've learned that lesson. It's not easy. You have to deal with people you don't like. Some are smart, some are dumb, some are honest, some are dishonest, some are crooks, some are people that really want to get things done. It's a cross-section of America. But you have to engage. You got to deal with those people. That's the nature of legislating. I mean, I wish that logic could prevail in Washington. It doesn't work that way. You can present, logical, positions, but ultimately you then have to roll up your sleeves and make sure that you get the votes you need in order to get things done. I mean, that movie Lincoln, it was very good to make the point. Abraham Lincoln wants passed the 13th Amendment. He's willing to go after every damn vote you need, even if you have to buy the votes, in order to get the 13th Amendment passed. I have seen that same process time and time again. When we were passing the Clinton budget, I think I had to sell about 6 bridges to get the votes I needed in order to pass that budget. But you do that because it's worth it. That's what legislating is all about. And that's what's missing today, is that inspiration to work together, to give and take, to get something done. That's what's needed today in order to do the right thing in Washington.
And the phrase used to be that politics at least stops at the water's edge, that whatever our fights are about domestic policy, that in terms of international relations and particularly threats to safety, that Democrats and Republicans will come together.
Yeah.
And I think clearly that has changed as well. I wanted to dig a little bit deeper with you and think about why, because it seems that the nature of the threat has changed. In the period in which you have been director of the CIA and then Secretary of Defense, we've gone from everywhere from North Korea to Libya to the Ukraine and Russia more recently, and now we're back in Iraq again, worried about Iraq and Syria. It moves very quickly. It's very asymmetrical. It's very different than, I think, the more conventional coalitions against a easily identified threat that happened in World War II and the post-World War II era. So is it about the fact that the threat is different? Is it about the fact that the media is different? Is it that the Congress profile is different? What has changed, and what do we need to do about it?
The answer is yes. I often get that question. What's changed? Because as I've described Washington that worked and the Washington that you see today, what are the reasons for this tremendous partisanship and gridlock and confrontation that we see today? And there's a number of factors that feed into it. There isn't just one silver bullet. I wish there were. There are a number of factors. One is the margin of power, is very thin, both the House and the Senate. So both parties are very partisan in making sure they go after that power. And they require, as a result of that, a lot more confrontation with the other party in order to show the differences. So that's one thing. Two, the redistricting process. And by the way, you know, California made a reform on redistricting, and it was a good reform because it provided for a commission to do the redistricting. Rather than having the parties cut a deal, creating safe Republican, safe Democratic seats, most of the redistricting in the country is a deal in which you create these safe seats. And so if you create a safe seat, then you don't worry about the center. You worry about people running against you from the extremes. So if you're a Republican, you worry about a Tea Party guy running to your right. And if you're a Democrat, you worry about somebody running to your left. So it tends to move members more to the extremes than to the center. And that's a reality. Thirdly, there's a hell of a lot of money in politics now. Too damn much money. And it's coming from PACs of every kind. The Supreme Court basically lifted the limits on most of this stuff. It's a wide open race for money. And if you're out there getting that kind of money, it's coming from special interests that don't particularly want you to make any waves or make any changes. And so that has a tremendous influence in the gridlock. Then the media, frankly. The media is interested in sound bites. They aren't interested in people working together. You know, you've got, you know, more and more media. They're more oriented to either the left or the right. And so they're all working off sound bites. And so the parties work off sound bites rather than really trying to work together. All of that feeds in to a situation where members simply don't want to take the risks necessary to lead. I've often said, in a democracy, it only works, you only govern through leadership or crisis. If leadership is there and willing to take the risks, you can get it done. But if it's not there, you govern by crisis, and crisis drives the process. So here we are at a time when we're facing, obviously, a number of serious issues here at home. And so because of the partisanship and gridlock, there's almost a sense of giving up on dealing with those issues that are important, immigration reform, issues like infrastructure funding and all the other things that we need to confront. And the same thing becomes true in dealing with foreign policy. We're dealing with so many threats that now it becomes almost immediately political when the president has to deal with a crisis abroad. And I have never seen as many different threats as we confront in the world today. And it isn't just terrorism and ISIS and Al-Qaeda, which is a serious threat out there to our country. It's also dealing with Iran. It's also dealing with North Korea, a country that is nuclear armed and has the capacity to use an ICBM to deliver that kind of weapon. And they've got a nutty dealer, a leader. This kid, I don't know where the hell he's at. The only one, you know, I mean, we don't know what he's thinking. We don't know what he's working on. He's totally unpredictable. You've got the problem with Russia and Putin and probably a new chapter in the Cold War. You've got to deal with China making territorial claims and doing some of the things that challenge international rules. And you've got cyber threats out there. We live in a world in which cyber attacks are probably the battlefield of the future and have the potential to virtually cripple this country. So you have all of these threats that have to be dealt with in a political situation that is in gridlock and stalemate and partisanship. If we have another 2.5 years of stalemate, which is likely, no matter what happens in this next election, then I really worry that our inability to deal with the issues facing this country, our economic issues, our social issues, and at the same time not have unity in terms of dealing with these threats abroad, that we could do incredible damage to this country. And that's why I keep stressing that the leadership, both president and leadership in the Congress, really do have to work together to deal with these issues. The country is at stake.
And one of the things that's really striking, I think, in your book is when you talk about some of the relatively current issues and crises that you've dealt with, how often the experience not only of working across party lines, but actually the ways in which you led and worked with people within the CIA and within the Defense Department. And one that I thought was particularly telling, which is more about challenge and inspiration and focusing on the good of the whole, than it was the cross-party bit, was when you first came in the CIA and the president said to you, the number one job is taking care of Osama bin Laden. And you found that they actually hadn't been focused. They'd kind of lost their focus on that issue. And along with a lot of clarity about focus and cajoling, you had this great moment that you talk about in the book, and I'd like you to talk about a little bit here, where you said, I want 10 ideas by Monday morning that are new and different, and we have to do this. Yeah. You talk a little bit about that? Because that is a different side of political cajoling, which ended up being profoundly effective.
Well, it's, look, just in general terms, I'm often asked, how do you manage the various agencies and departments that I've led in one way or another. And a big part of it is that you have got to constantly challenge people. You got to challenge them to do the job. What we're seeing today, whether it's the VA or what you see happening in terms of even dealing with the Ebola crisis or the IRS or the Secret Service, is people start, they do things by the numbers. They move stuff from the inbox to the outbox. They don't really roll up their sleeves. They don't realize, the impact that you can have on people's lives. The VA thing is particularly disturbing, that, you're not delivering what you should be delivering to people in need. And you have to, my experience was you just have to challenge people. You've got to make them know that they have a responsibility, a bigger responsibility, to do their job. And you've got to hold them accountable. And so, when I went to the CIA, President made clear that going after bin Laden was a big priority, as I believed. And so when I met with our team there, they described how frustrated they were, that every lead had led to a dead end. They hadn't really have any good information on where he was since Tora Bora, which was, at the 2001. And I said, well, what are you doing to try to develop leads? And they said, well, we've just been waiting for, some kind of intelligence information. I said, that's not good enough. You've got to go out and create the opportunities. And so I created a team, a task force, and I said, I want you to brief me every week. And when you come here, I want to hear, your ideas for what we're doing to make sure we go after them. And sometimes they'd come in and they'd say, well, we haven't developed anything. I said, that's not good enough. I want you to come up with 10 ideas that, I don't care how crazy they are. Just give me 10 ideas about how we can try to have a better lead on bin Laden. And so, they really did begin to work at it. And we developed, there were kind of three different approaches that we initially talked about. One was that we were going to try to track one of Osama bin Laden's sons who was in captivity in Iran, house arrest in Iran. And they eventually released him. And so we thought if we follow him, he might lead us to bin Laden. We did. And he got involved with the wrong crowd in Pakistan. And it was a crowd that we were targeting with other operations. And so he got wiped out along with everybody else in that shot. And so that took care of that lead. And then we decided we would use some technology to try to see if we could find him, because he was using computers and that kind of thing. And that didn't quite work. Finally, we focused on the couriers. Bin Laden used couriers to deliver, the messages that he wanted to deliver, the speeches and the various things he did. We didn't know who these couriers were. And eventually, by going back and piecing together bits and pieces of intelligence, we were able to identify the couriers. And then, even more importantly, we attached a face to the name. And we were able to locate them in a town called Peshawar in Pakistan. We located them. We saw, we saw the vehicle that they had, and we tracked the vehicle that led us to Abbottabad in this compound. And when we got to the compound, we knew something different about this compound just made us excited. Why? Here was a compound. It was three times the size of other compounds, had 18-foot walls on one side, 12-foot walls on another side. They had an 8-foot wall on the third floor, for God's sakes. Third floor, you usually want to see the view. They had an 8-foot wall there, barbed wire. So they had a tremendous amount of security. So something was going on. And we were immediately interested in trying to identify who was there. This is Bin Laden's couriers. They've got a compound with all the security. What's going on? And so that's what led us to doing a tremendous amount of surveillance to try to locate, what was going on there. And we used all kinds of, ways to try to get information. Now, just one thing I'll tell you is we were doing surveillance, we saw a gentleman who would go out into a yard and walk in circles like a prisoner in a prison yard. And I said, I knew this, the gentleman was a little older, and I said, for God's sakes, this is a chance to identify this person, see whether it's Bin Laden. So, put a telescope on the mountain, put cameras on the walls, do something to give me an ID on a facial identity of this individual. And they said, no, we just can't. I mean, the walls are in the way. It's too risky. We don't know quite how to do this. I said, I've seen movies where the CIA can do this,
The CIA's from California. Like I said.
we never got an ID. I finally said, look, can you tell me how tall he is, for goodness sakes? Because, Bin Laden was 6'5". Tell me how tall he is by the shadows. And they said, well, we might be able to do that. And they came back and told me that the gentleman's height was somewhere between 5'7" and 6'5". And I said, that didn't do much good either. But eventually, we pieced together, I felt, enough intelligence that warranted the operation, and the president then told us to do the operations. And it was risky because we never had, 100% ID. But I do have to tell you that the dedication of the intelligence people, the capability of our special forces to conduct the operation, that was a remarkable combination that resulted in a mission that was very difficult. Very complex, 150 miles at night into Pakistan, and not knowing exactly what you were going to run into. I give tremendous credit to the president for making a gutsy decision to do it, because frankly, when we went to the National Security Council, most of the members in the NSC thought that it was too risky to do.
So you have some great lines in the book and reflections, and I encourage people to look at it just to hear about things that capture something that we know, but we couldn't say it so succinctly, like there was no such thing as a short meeting with President Clinton. I think that seems right. But I'm wondering, one of the things that struck me in the book was how many times Sylvia ended up being on the hotline. You would be out grilling, or you'd be out finally enjoying being back home, and the phone would ring, and poor Sylvia has to call you in and say the White House or someone else is on the line, and it was usually someone calling you for the next public service job. So I have two related questions for you. The first, because you've gotten that call so many times, is in a couple of years, 2.5 years, we have a new president. What are the top foreign policy issues, because things do move so quickly, what are the top foreign policy issues do you think they'll still be facing? And the second and not unrelated question is, if you get that call again, will you say yes again? Or will Sylvia just hang up the phone?
I think Sylvia will hang up the phone. I've enjoyed public service. I've always responded to presidents when they've asked me to serve because of what my parents used to say about, giving something back to the country. And I've enjoyed all of my positions. But I think right now I'd like to work with a different set of nuts back in Carmel Valley. It's going to be a challenge for whoever becomes president with regards to foreign policy issues, because I don't, You know, I don't know if many of these will be resolved by the time the next president takes office. We do have this war on terrorism, and I consider it part of kind of one continuum going back to 9/11. 9/11 was a major attack on this country by Al-Qaeda that killed 3,000 people. And we declared war on terrorism as a result of that to make sure that not only would we go after those who attacked our country, but that we would make sure that it never happened again. 9/11 would never happen again. Very frankly, we developed pretty effective operations, both intelligence operations and military operations, to be able to go after that threat. But terrorism has metastasized to ISIS, which is an even more fanatical version of Al-Qaeda, with similar threats. And we've seen what they've done in Iraq and Syria and the threat that they represent. But we also have Boko Haram in Nigeria. We also have Al-Shabaab in Somalia. We have other elements of Al-Qaeda throughout North Africa that are involved. So this war against terrorism is going to be a very long-term effort to try to deal with those threats. And we can do this. I have great confidence. We've developed a counterterrorism capability to be able to confront them and do it well. But we are also going to have to develop an element of fighting terrorism that we have not done very well, which is to also work on the cultural and religious and economic aspects that have young people in the Muslim world turning to this kind of extremism to become terrorists. We have got to develop a way to try to reach those individuals. We'll have to work with the countries that are there, Saudi Arabia, UAE, others. We're going to have to work with them to try to reach out to young people so that we give them a sense that, you know, there is a greater opportunity to be able to live and to enjoy family rather than live as a terrorist. And so that's something that's going to take a long time. And a new president is going to have to deal with that. We're going to have to deal with Russia and Putin. Putin obviously is engaged in a new threatening attitude to try to go back at those countries that were part of the old Soviet Union, reassert their influence over those countries. We're going to have to make clear that that cannot happen. So we're going to have to draw some lines on Putin. And at the same time, find ways, hopefully, to reach out and see whether he's willing to work with us in those efforts. We've got to deal with Iran. Iran has 19,000 centrifuges. They want to enrich fuel. They have the ability to develop, are working on the ability to develop perhaps a nuclear weapon. And if that, if that happens, that could be a real threat to peace in the Middle East. So we're in negotiations now. Whether we're successful or not remains to be determined. We have to deal with North Korea and make sure that we are prepared for any kind of possible aggression from North Korea. We have to deal with China and have a constant dialogue with China. We're going to have to deal with, as I said, the cyber threat that's out there. So a new president is going to have to be able to provide the leadership in the world to deal with every one of those threats. I mean, one thing we're finding is from recent events, and I understand why the president was interested in we've been at war for over 10 years, wanting to turn inward towards this country to deal with the problems here. But as recent events have shown, if the United States is not providing world leadership, nobody else will. As the president himself said, when crisis happens, nobody calls China, nobody calls Russia, you call the United States. And so we are going to have to remain strong leaders in the world of the 21st century. Why? Because we are the one country that has the value system that I think can try to assure an effort towards greater peace and prosperity in the world. That's going to be the challenge for the next president.
you embody that value system, and in it's evolved from sleeping in the parking lot in a car behind behind Meadowlands right. to saying
a hell of a lot of Hail Marys in addition to that.
That part, the Hail Marys part, hasn't changed. Right? Well, I could obviously talk to you all afternoon, but I want to make sure that our audience has a chance to hear some of their questions asked, and I'm sure that they will hit some of the contemporary events that I didn't address directly. So, Elaine.
Right. Thank you.